This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Technik, die bewegt. Design, das begeistert. Erlebe Elektromobilität in neuem Licht. Mit dem neuen innovativen Kia EV4 und dem neuen geräumigen SUV Kia EV5. Entdecke beide vollelektrischen Modelle ab 17. Januar bei uns.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
You're about to listen to a brand new series of Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley. Episodes will be released weekly wherever you get your podcasts, but if you can't wait, head over to BBC Sounds, where you can listen to the latest episodes a whole week earlier, first on BBC Sounds. If you'd like to stay up to date with the latest episodes, make sure you subscribe to Lady Killers on the BBC Sounds app and have push notifications switched on.
Good afternoon, everybody. Let me tell you what's going to happen now. You will enjoy yourselves. In a second, I'm going to invite the Lady Killers team onto the stage, and when they come up, I would like, please, some tumultuous applause. What kind of applause do I want?
Tumultuous!
That's it. Hello and welcome to Lady Killers Live, Murder by the Book. We're coming to you from the BBC Marquee at the Hay Festival. We're in beautiful Hay-on-Wye, which for this week at least is undoubtedly the literary capital of the world, isn't it? Hello, everybody in the tent. Welcome, welcome. The wind is whistling through our tent, creating an extra spooky feel for us. Today, we're bringing you true crime. That's our thing. But this time, we're taking a literary twist. We will meet some real-life lady killers, women who captured the imagination of some of our greatest writers, murderesses who live on in print. As ever, we'll be looking at history, and especially for you today, at literature through the eyes of modern-day feminists. We will meet Edith Thompson, an ordinary woman in 1920s suburbia who finds herself on trial for murder.
The doctor came and told me my husband was dead.
We'll hear how she inspired today's guest detective to write a beautiful and devastating love story.
But the tears were running from Lillian's eyes now. She was trembling again. And it was impossible to do anything but go over to her and embrace her. And in clutching at each other, they both grew a little calmer.
We'll meet Maria Manning, a murderous Victorian lady's maid.
We beat him dreadfully upon the floor. We washed our hands in his crimson gore.
Now, she resurfaces in Bleak House by Charles Dickens as Lady Dedlock's maid Hortense, who gets pursued by a relentless detective called Mr. Bucket.
Mademoiselle, with that tigerish expansion of the mouth and her black eyes darting fire upon him, sits upright on the sofa in a rigid state, with her hands clenched, and her feet too, one might suppose, muttering, "Oh, Mr. Bucket, you are a devil!"
And we'll remember Margaret Garner, an enslaved woman desperate to protect her children.
I would much rather kill them at once and thus end their sufferings than have them taken back to slavery and be murdered by piecemeal.
Whose life prompted Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison to write Beloved, the story of a family mercilessly ripped apart.
The shock was learning that nobody stopped playing checkers just because the pieces included her children. Her two girls, neither of whom had their adult teeth, were sold and gone, and she had not been able to wave goodbye.
As ever on Lady Killers, we're an all-female team. I'm glad to say that today's guest detective is someone who writes historical fiction with remarkable insight. It's the award-winning author of Tipping the Velvet, Fingersmith, and The Little Stranger. It's only Sarah Waters. And, of course, we could not get on without our illustrious in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone from the Open University. Hello, Ros. Hi, Ros. How are you doing?
Good, thanks, Lucy.
Well, a look at any bookshelf will tell you that real-life people inspire fictional characters. It happens all the time. Sarah, do you often get asked if your characters are based on real people?
I do get asked that quite a lot, actually. And also, some people send me the stories of real people that they think deserve a novel. But on the whole, I prefer to find my own way to a story. Somehow, I find that's part of the process, really.
When people told Agatha Christie that they had given her the ideas for her plots, she'd just smile sweetly and say, "Yeah, yeah, you did." Let's get into this. Ros, who is today's first murderess?
Well, our first case is Edith Thompson. Living in 1922, Edith is the epitome of the modern woman. She's got a great short haircut, nice short skirt. She has a career in fashion. And of course, she commutes to this amazing job by train from Ilford, the up-and-coming suburb of 1920s London. She lives there with her husband, Percy, and also for a time, her lover, Freddie Bywaters.
Husband and her lover. This seems rather modern for 1922.
Yeah, Freddie is a lot younger than Edith. He's a sailor and he goes away to sea. And while he's away, the couple exchange letters that are rather racy and saucy.
"Even when you're cross with me, I'll ruffle all your hair lots of times until you have to melt and smile at me. And then you'll take me in both your arms and hold me so tight I can't breathe. And kiss me all over until I have to say, stop! Stop at once!"
That was Scorchio, wasn't it? But it all ends very badly for Edith, doesn't it, Ros?
Spoiler alert. One evening, Edith and Percy are walking home from the train station and Freddie springs out from the bushes and stabs Percy to death.
Now, Sarah, your completely fabulous novel, The Paying Guests, I love that one. I think you've called it in the past a love story that's complicated by crime. What part did the real-life Edith Thompson case play in inspiring the story?
Well, I hadn't planned to write at all about Edith Thompson. I wanted to write a book with a 1920s suburban setting rather than the more familiar high society setting. And I knew a bit about Edith's case, and I went to research it, just really looking for incidental detail about 1920s life. But the more I read about it, the more gripped I became by it. She's such an extraordinary person. And I became gripped by this kind of crime, I think, because it's very domestic. There's something very relatable about it, I found. It's the sort of crime you could almost, in a horrible way, imagine yourself being sucked into on a really bad day. So I did. Maybe that's just me. The Paying Guest isn't at all Edith's story. She doesn't appear in it as a character. But I wanted to write a novel in which my characters start off like her, thinking they're in a love story, and then through one dreadful, ill-advised act, it turns into something much more nightmarish.
A big difference as well is that the two lovers are female in your story.
Yes. But I thought, well, what would happen if you keep a love triangle but make the lover female? From my point of view, all sorts of delicious things started happening.
I loved the expression on your face when you said that. Now, I'm thrilled that you're going to read us a bit from The Paying Guests. Which characters are we about to meet?
So this scene is from quite early on in the book, and the main character in the book is Frances, who's a young spinster daughter living with her mother in suburban South London. They're middle class, and this was a period, the early 20s, when the middle classes financially weren't doing very well. So she and her mother have been obliged to take in lodgers, or in that wonderfully British euphemism, paying guests. And Mr. and Mrs. Barber, Leonard and Lillian, a young married couple, from what was known as the clerk class, in other words, the lower middle class. So at this point, Frances and Mrs. Barber have begun to be friends, and they've come on a picnic to their local park.
Now, Sarah, just before you begin, I must warn you that Roz here is something of an expert on illicit liaisons in parks. Right, Roz? We've been to all sorts of interesting locations together, like prison cells and railway stations and graveyards and the park in Ilford, where Edith and Freddie used to meet for outdoor sex. Now, outdoor sex in a park, that's pretty risky behaviour for a married woman in the 1920s, I'd have thought, Roz.
Yeah, and probably today as well.
Okay. But Sarah, I don't think we're going to hear a sex scene just now.
No, but maybe there's a tiny hint of a flirtation as the background to this scene. What's happened here is that they finished their picnic, been strolling around, and they've wandered up into the park's empty bandstand, where they've been interrupted by a man, much to Francis's annoyance. He was the man who'd been watching them earlier on. He must have seen them finish their tea and been following them ever since, from the bench to the flowerbeds, from the flowerbeds to the pond, from the pond to the tennis courts, from the tennis courts to here. Of course, the red parasol made them rather hard to miss. That wasn't why Mrs. Barber had brought it, though surely that wasn't why she'd wanted to sit here in this oddly public spot. No, of course it wasn't. She was doing her best to ignore the man, her head dipped, her face flaming. He ducked his own head in an attempt to catch her eye. "Don't want to play," he said. "Look, go away, will you?" said Francis. He looked at her with a gaze grown fishy, then spoke to Mrs. Barber again, turning down the corners of his mouth. "Your chum doesn't seem to like me much. I can't think why. How about you?" Francis said, "No, she doesn't like you either. Do go away." He held his ground for another few moments, but it was Mrs. Barber he was after, and she wouldn't raise her eyes to his. At last, there was nothing he could do but give up on them both. He drew in his shoulders, pretending to shudder against the chill, and, "Boo," he said, still addressing Mrs. Barber, but jerking his head in Francis's direction. "Suffragette, is she?" No one answered him. He retreated, got out a cigarette, produced a lighter, struck a flame, all in a leisurely sort of way, as if it was the only thing he'd climbed the steps for. But the twinkle had faded from his manner, and after a moment he drifted back to his previous spot at the balustrade. A moment after that, he left the bandstand. Mrs. Barber's pose loosened. She looked embarrassed, admiring, appalled, but she laughed. "Oh, Miss Ray, what a tartar you are." "Well," said Francis, still furious, "why should our nice day be spoiled simply because some fool of a man fancies himself a lady killer?"
Hey, a lady killer in its original form as well. We've reclaimed it, obviously. The scenario feels so true to life. I think we can all recognise the feelings there. But the language as well is so 1920s. How do you achieve that, Sarah?
Well, one great resource for me when I'm researching it is actually the literature of a period. On the most basic level, it gives you vocabulary, details about clothing and houses and streets and things like that. But on a deeper level, it takes you into the mentality of a period. And sometimes, actually, popular fiction does this more than literary fiction, because, of course, it was popular for a reason. It touched on the hot issues of the day. So in the early 1920s, for example, I discovered that there was a rash of novels published about men who'd returned from the war, very tired, only to discover that the country that they'd been fighting for had kind of moved on without them and was a bit bewildering. And was full of newly independent women, women a bit like Edith Thompson, I think.
Technik, die bewegt. Design, das begeistert. Erlebe Elektromobilität in neuem Licht. Mit dem neuen innovativen Kia EV4 und dem neuen geräumigen SUV Kia EV5. Entdecke beide vollelektrischen Modelle ab 17. Januar bei uns. Kia. Movement that inspires.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long-simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
If you're just joining us, we're here at the Hay Festival with Lady Killers Live, and there is a terrible storm raging about us. As we're talking about violent death, it all seems very appropriate. So coming back to Edith's case and how it unfolded in real life, it is true that she wrote all of these saucy letters to her lover, Freddie, in which she does mention the idea of using violence against her husband, Percy. But Edith seems to have had no idea at all that her lover, Freddie, was actually planning this attack.
I heard Percy call out, and he fell up against me. I felt him and found his clothing wet with blood. He never moved after he fell. We had no quarrel on the way. We were quite happy together.
Yeah, both Freddie and Edith are tried and convicted and hanged for the murder of Percy, even though Edith actually never touches him at all.
Roz, how on earth did that end up happening?
Well, it was all down to the letters, really. Letters that Edith was writing to Freddie. And in the trial, there was actually quite a bit of public sympathy for Edith, right up until the point that the prosecution introduced those letters. And they served to recast her, really, as a dangerous woman who'd taken advantage of this vulnerable young man at a time when there was a lot of public sympathy for these men returning from the war. She becomes this dangerous woman. Her sophistication, her fashion choice, the age, it turns against her.
And I think she was damned in that very British way for having ideas above her station, for wanting too much, for being desiring, not just sexually, but for being ambitious too. So there's an awful lot of snobbery that comes out in the response to Edith. People called her Madame Bovary in a bun shop, as if people who live in the suburbs aren't allowed to have complicated, tragic lives.
Interesting. Once a person wrote a letter of complaint to my boss about me, accusing me of being ambitious. Guess what gender that person was? Now, on to another lady killer immortalised in print. We're off to Bermondsey, South London, in 1849. When the police find a man buried in quicklime underneath the flagstones of a kitchen floor, the murderers are a husband and wife team, Frederick and Maria Manning, who've been having a kind of a threesome with the victim, a Mr. Patrick O'Connor. Maria is Swiss. She has worked as a lady's maid to the aristocracy. She's very much the brains behind the operation. She invites the lover, Patrick, over for dinner, but he gets a bit more than he'd bargained for.
We premeditated to take his life. To our home, invited him one Thursday night. The murderous weapons we had prepared, and we trepanned him into a fatal snare. I fond caressed him that fateful night, when my breast was raging with spleen and spite. The gun I fired, deep was the wound. Then he fell bleeding upon the fatal ground.
Maria Manning was compared to one of the greatest female characters ever written. They called her, I love this, the Lady Macbeth of Bermondsey. So, Maria was executed alongside her slightly useless husband on the roof of Horsemonger Lane Jail. And amid the vast crowd of gawpers, Ros, there was a very significant author present, wasn't there?
Absolutely. Charles Dickens got together with a group of friends and they rented a room with a view of the scaffold. And they also had a great view of the crowd who turned up jolly, boisterous, some of them were drunk. It was like a fairground atmosphere. And Dickens was so disgusted with this that he wrote two letters to the Times afterwards. And he said that really execution shouldn't be done in public because it was having such a bad effect on the people.
Just 3 years after Maria's execution, Dickens publishes his ninth novel, Bleak House. Over the course of 18 months, there were 20 instalments at a shilling apiece, rather like a long-running Victorian soap opera. Sarah, can you please summarise Bleak House for us?
Not really, no, because it's a bit like asking me to summarise Game of Thrones. It's one of Dickens's gloriously huge novels with an enormous cast of characters, many narrative threads, all linked to an interminable court case. But one of the characters is the beautiful and enigmatic Lady Dedlock. She has a lady's maid called Hortense, who gets a bit bitter and vengeful when Lady Dedlock dismisses her in favour of a younger, prettier girl.
Hortense, yes, she's the key character for us. In 1852, when Dickens published the first instalments of Bleak House, Maria Manning was still incredibly famous. So Dickens's description of Hortense would have been immediately recognisable.
My lady's maid is a French woman of 32, from somewhere in the southern country, about Avignon and Marseille. A large-eyed brown woman with black hair, who would be handsome but for a certain feline mouth and general uncomfortable tightness of face, rendering the jaws too eager and the skull too prominent. There is something indefinably keen and wan about her anatomy, and she has a watchful way of looking out of the corners of her eyes without turning her head, which could be pleasantly dispensed with, especially when she is in an ill humour and near knives. Through all the good taste of her dress and little adornments, these objections so express themselves that she seems to go about like a very neat she-wolf, imperfectly tamed.
Oh, I love that. Maria and Hortense, both ladies' maids, both foreign, both a little bit feral and out of control, and both murderous. Sarah, the parallels are obvious, but why do you think Dickens chose to resurrect Maria Manning in the shape of Hortense the maid? Why does she make such a good baddie?
She does make a brilliant baddie, doesn't she? And I always get the feeling that Dickens really enjoyed writing her, that he enjoyed how insubordinate she is. I think she represents the sexual transgressions that Dickens couldn't overtly show the sort of respectable British characters performing, as you've said. You know, he's really exploiting a stereotype of Frenchified women being a bit ferocious and uncontrollable.
Sarah, I think you could call Bleak House a detective novel, couldn't you? Because of the way the policeman goes after and catches the killer.
Absolutely. I mean, it always amazes me when I reread it how solidly a detective novel it is. You know, how all the staples of the genre are right there. You've got the hunt for Tulkinghorn's killer. You've got narrative red herrings. The wrong man's arrested. Oh, no. You know, you've got Inspector Bucket's big reveal near the end of the book where we discover exactly what's been going on. And it's a very long way from that rather squalid murder in Bermondsey. And I think that's interesting, too. I think as far as Maria Manning goes, Dickens kind of has his cake and eats it. You know, in real life, he absolutely deplored her crime, of course. But Bleak House needed a murderess, and he was very happy to use her story for his own purposes and make it entertaining. That's a staple of detective fiction, too. It sanitises murder and offers it up to us as fun, really, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Well, only a few years later, in 1856... a woman in the southern United States faces very different circumstances. Margaret Garner is 22 years old. She's got four small children. She's pregnant with her fifth. And in the depths of winter, she escapes slavery in rural Kentucky. She's hiding with relatives in Cincinnati when her so-called owner comes back with a written warrant under the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act for the return of his human property. He means Margaret and all her children too. Roz, can you pick up the story for us here?
Margaret's really faced with an impossible situation. There's a really large and hostile crowd outside the house, and Margaret knows that if her children are taken back to Kentucky, they face a lifetime of degradation. The crowd force entry into the house, and her family's capture is now inevitable. So Margaret, feeling she has no choice, grabs a butcher's knife and slits the throat of her daughter, her two-year-old daughter, Mary.
I was as cool as I am now. If I'd had more time, I would have killed them all. Now little Mary is free from all trouble and sorrow. She was my own, given me of God to do the best a mother could. I did the best I could. I knew it was better for them to go home to God than back to slavery. The days of suffering, the nights of unmitigated toil. Slavery is more cruel than death.
Roz, how do we know that Margaret said those words?
Well, those words were written down and later reported by one of two clergymen who visited her in jail. And it's so often the case with killers that we feature in our series that we hear their voices, but through men. And, you know, when a woman commits a crime, it creates this abundance of records, but these come with filters. And our job is to understand those filters and to try to read against the grain, and also to understand the gaps and the silences, what they tell us and what they don't tell us.
Now, nearly 120 years later, Toni Morrison came across a newspaper clipping that summarised Margaret Garner's story. And from that, she conjured up the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Beloved, in which she reimagines Margaret as an enslaved woman called Setha, haunted by the daughter she killed. Sarah, Beloved is a beloved masterpiece. As an author, what do you admire about it?
God, it's an amazing book, isn't it? And I think what I admire most is its breadth of vision, really. You know, it takes Margaret Garner's case and turns it into the story of Setha, but it also gives us the stories of the people around Setha, her extended family. Bit by bit, we get these stories that build up a collective picture of the horrors of life under slavery. We're even at one point taken into the hold of a slave ship through the kind of hallucinatory memories of Beloved herself, the dead daughter who returns as a ghost. And really, I think what it's doing is it's taking that original crime that Margaret Garner committed and suggesting or revealing that the crime that really took place there, of course, was the crime that was committed against Margaret Garner and against the millions of people who were abused by slavery, that it was ultimately a crime against humanity. And that's an amazing imaginative leap, I think.
Sarah, can fiction sometimes communicate more than factual narrative?
I think it can. I think a good historical novel should respect the difference of the past, should try and represent the truth of the past somehow. But I think you can do that in really quite creative ways. It feels terribly grand to be talking about myself alongside Dickens and Toni Morrison, but if I can talk about my own experience, I'll sort of start a novel with an intense period of research, which will give me my characters and my plot and my setting. But once my characters have begun to come to life, I'll sort of let the research go a bit in order to devote myself to them, because I'm very conscious that I'm writing a novel and it has to work on its own imaginative terms. But hopefully, because my characters will have that grounding from the basic research, they will be able to tell us something, I hope, a bit truthful about the period.
Well, let's hear from you. What's a historian's view of historical fiction?
I do love historical fiction. I do read a lot of it. And I think historical fiction, well done, can make the past really accessible and digestible and can really help us use the past to reflect on our present, as good historical writing should as well. It's great to have both, and we should have a really stimulating, engaging conversation between the two. But the boundaries are very important.
I thought you might say that. Roz keeps us all in line here on Lady Killers. Now, Sarah, I'd love to know what you think. Do you think it's possible that women can write murderesses better than men can?
I can think of lots of male authors who write absolutely brilliant, believable women characters, no doubt about that. But I think when it comes to crime and murder, the pressures pushing women into crime in real life are often very gendered ones. They've often been coerced or controlled or abused by men. So maybe a woman author would have a slightly more sensitivity to those dynamics. I'm always struck by something that Dickens said when he went to see Maria Manning hanged. It's a rather grisly image, but he said that when her body dropped and swung there, it was so elaborately dressed and corseted that it held its shape. And it's an amazing image, isn't it? And from a feminist point of view, I think it reminds us how often throughout history, femininity has been a matter of performance, with clothes often doing the performing for you to the extent that they carry on doing it after you're dead. Dickens was very much outside that body, no experience of what it's like to have a female body in a patriarchal society. Perhaps a woman writer might be better at getting kind of inside the corset.
Inside the corset.
Yeah.
That is a great way of putting it. Well, I'm so sorry to say we've run out of time. Thank you, everybody. We've come to the final page, but it's been such a joy to be here with you today at the Hay Festival. Thank you for being with us as we've tried to separate fact from fiction in this special episode of Lady Killers, Murder by the Book. A huge thank you to our guest detective Sarah Waters, our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone. An enormous admiration to our wonderful voice actor, Claire Corbett, and to Moya Angela for our Margaret Garner readings. Until next time, goodbye, everybody. Wasn't that a treat? And the treats continue, because our all-new season is next, starting with Lady Killer in My Family.
a listener brings us an intriguing case of a murder-suicide in her family and asks us to investigate. Lady Killers Live with Lucy Worsley is produced by Sarah Goodman. The assistant producer is Rhian Musa. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. And the commissioning editor is Rhian Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can listen to the new season on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. See you next time. Hi, listeners. It's me again. Just before you go, if you like history and you want something the whole family can enjoy, there's a brand new podcast I think that you'll love. It's called Dead Funny History, and it's from the team behind You're Dead to Me. It's packed with fascinating stories and plenty of laughs. I think it's perfect for budding historians of all ages. There are episodes on the history of football, Ramesses the Great, the Bronte sisters, and many more. Just search for Dead Funny History on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.